TFM.
Welcome back, everyone, to Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, just stop where you are. I know that little box of glowing orange balls over there is really cool, but just please don't stare into those.
But Chris, I want to touch them. They look so cool. Look how they light up. They're probably just fireflies in there, right?
Exactly. That's all they are. They're fireflies. They're going to put them in what we call in Japan, a gacha machine, where you put the coin in and twist the knob and a little plastic container comes out and you get a prize inside. And that's what it is. And it's fireflies. Yeah.
I feel like I have just kind of put that quarter in and I got that little, firefly ball. It's really enjoyable. It's good stuff. I'm so glad that we're getting an episode like this.
Yeah. Well, at least you didn't get the Dallas Cowboys helmet for the 12th time when you're trying to get the 49ers helmet out of the machine at Kmart.
Who wants the Cowboys helmet? That's probably the problem there. So that's why there's so many of them.
Yeah. I already have enough to make a whole team out of it, but anyway, yes, everyone, we're going to continue our discussion of the third season of Strange New Worlds today with episode 5. This is Through the Lens of Time, and here is a quick rundown of the story. Nurse Chapel's new beau, Dr. Roger Corby, pays a visit to the Enterprise to get help with a dig on Vadia 9, a planet that's home to the descendants of an ancient, highly advanced civilization believed to have been capable of traveling across multiple galaxies and to have discovered immortality. The mission quickly takes a dangerous turn when the landing party becomes trapped inside a temple. Or is it a prison? The structure and technology are clearly ancient and advanced, but uncovering their mysteries won't be easy. The team finds itself split up, trapped in different rooms, or maybe planes of existence. But they can still talk to each other and must put their noggins together and romantic tension aside to escape. Meanwhile, back on the ship, a lizard fight has broken out in sick bay. So, Matthew... This episode is, it's a little bit, what, Tomb Raider meets Indiana Jones?
Yeah, I mean, so I mentioned that I felt like this episode was Indiana Jones has a baby with Tomb Raider, Harry Potter, Times Arrow. And it's like they all got together and created a baby. And so there's little bits and pieces of each one of those. I mean, there's larger portions of Indiana Jones, Tomb Raider, and Times Arrow kind of thing happening here. And, you know, I think the whole idea of having Christine Chapel, Tomb Raider, is awesome. I would say
she does play the role well, I will say.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. I will say it doesn't make any sense whatsoever for her to have been with Corby for 3 months on this, fellowship and now be the one, somehow in charge of leading this mission that legitimately makes no sense when, this is Corby's job that he's been doing for a very long time. So I thought that was a little bit ridiculous putting Chapel in charge of this the way that this episode does. It really makes zero sense.
Well, it makes sense in respect to something we can talk about later, which is that if you want to make an awkward situation for Spock, having his former girlfriend lead the charge when her current boyfriend is there, that's the only reason that really makes sense.
Yeah, which again doesn't make sense. This is one of the problems here, that instead of writing episodes based on what the story requires to tell, you're twisting things into all these knots for no good reason, and you can still have this tension without doing that whatsoever. You don't need that. That doesn't really help, I don't think, that tension. It's still there. Because, sure. You know, so as per just the episode in general, kind of shifting, I think, into a much more serious tone, that's wonderful. I think this season has had a really difficult time finding itself and finding a tone that actually kind of makes sense. And even just like the fact that this episode seems to begin to connect a lot of the different mysteries that we've seen, mm-hmm. I think is also very nice. Like we're starting to kind of make sense of some of the season, and you know, this feels a lot more like a lot of the groundwork that we kind of got in the first season, where it was really, you felt like there is this thread running through, and you know, led to the end of that season.
Mm-hmm.
That this begins, I think, to make sense of all that. And in all honesty, I mean, I think what's nice is the thing that we asked for in the previous episode, which is give us a focus on characters that were created specifically for this series. You know, we get those things in the interactions with La'an, and then of course with Chapel, with Corby, and then with Gamble, right? Mm-hmm. And we're getting a much more kind of character driven story. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're, you know, getting more on Mbenga, we're getting more on Battelle. I mean, like, yeah. this episode is a very, very much centered on the way in which what's happening to the characters impacts them. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, that's great storytelling. And so, you know, there, I'm going to have some quibbles here and there, but I feel like mm-hmm. on a whole, this is the type of episode that I would love to see way more of in the series. And I think they actually mm-hmm. did a pretty stinking good job of doing this and making me kind of invested back into the season mm-hmm. because we actually made even some of the absolute clunkers I feel like we've had this season maybe make a little bit more sense,
mm-hmm.
even if, you know, I would still have gone back and rewritten those episodes. But
yeah. Well, I would say even Mbenga is a character who was created for this series. Yes, he exists on the original
yeah.
series,
yeah,
but
true.
We didn't really know anything Agreed. About him, right? He's basically yeah. just a name, a character that we see very little of, and they pulled that in to make a connection to the original right. series. But so all the development that we're getting with him is also playing into what you're saying about yep. let's focus on the characters that are unique to the series. And mm-hmm. yeah, yes. I went back yesterday and watched the Elysium Kingdom from season one, where they have the resolution of the situation with Mbenga's daughter. And I hadn't watched that probably since we talked about it when it first aired. And at that time I watched it several times, but I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I actually had kind of forgotten the resolution of that because I was wondering for a second, right. if, well, this Vesda alien gets into the computer stored in the pattern buffer at the end of this episode. And, oh, is Mbinga's daughter still in there? And then he can take her over, but of course she's not, she's gone. And Gamble references that a little bit actually in the dialogue of this episode, but yeah, I like what they're doing there. And yeah, overall, one thing I liked about this episode is that, while yes, we talk about it, it takes a lot of cues from Indiana Jones and Tomb Raider and various modern films and franchises, it also has a feel that I could easily see this mystery on the original series. It feels like something that they could have encountered a place like this. And
oh, absolutely.
And had to yep. unravel this mystery. And so mm-hmm. it has a stronger tie, I feel, to the premise of this show from the beginning.
Absolutely.
Than most of the other stuff that we've been getting. You know, they went to a strange new world on strange new worlds. So good on that. And
yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think you're hands down 100% right. And that's, again, when I say that this is the type of stuff that I'm looking more for from this show. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, again, this was kind of the promise that we got in this show in the first season, right? Many mm-hmm. more of the episodes were much more like this than, you know, what we kind of got, I think, a lot in season two and, you know, in season three. Season one just felt so much more cohesive and connected and well written.
Yeah.
And again, maybe this is a great turning point for the series for season three. And especially since we know they're working on season four right now and they only have six episodes to wrap things up in season five. And so hopefully then their goal is to try and create something that is very cohesive moving forward, which I would love to see. And so, yeah, I, you know, again, this is for the complaints that you know, I've had for this season. I'm gonna be on the other side of the fence on this one, in the sense mm-hmm. that I loved this episode in many ways that I haven't any of the previous episodes.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about cohesion. It's going to turn out that the one thing that frightens the Vesda are puppets.
You had to bring that up and remind me that that's where we're going. I don't know why you had to do that.
It's the one thing
that
strikes fear into their ancient hearts.
I thought it was the Gorn, but apparently it's just puppets. It's just puppets.
Yeah. So this story, again, it's very interesting because it's an ancient puzzle with galactic implications. And the one thing that I really didn't think about when I was watching it, but is implied by earlier episodes in the season, is that this planet is the ancient homeworld of the Q. As
yes.
Trelane mentioned, he saw Corby digging around on the old homeworld.
Yep.
And so that raises all kinds of questions about the origins of the Q and how it plays into this idea of multiple galaxies and multiple planes of existence and mm-hmm. why there's a prison here and who's imprisoned and all this kind of stuff. Although when I was watching it, I was never thinking about, okay, how did the Q tie into this?
Yeah, I mean, so I remember just kind of watching the episode for the first time, and you know, they mentioned this whole idea about the fact that they're on this ancient homeworld of these beings who have achieved immortality. And so we know that was the ancient homeworld of the Q because of what we saw in Wedding Bell Blues. And so apparently then my theory is that, you know, the Q, in an attempt to achieve immortality by phase shifting, I don't know how you actually get to the point where you achieve that, but who knows, bring the Vesda from another dimension into our dimension. And so my guess is then that they are the ones who helped trap them in the orbs and imprison them within this layered dimensional prison on this planet. And I'm also guessing that before they were able to actually achieve that, this race, the Vesda, had an impact on this part of the galaxy. And I'm thinking that the Gorn had many interactions with them. And I'm also guessing that that's one of the reasons that the Gorn look the way they do, because there's something about their interactions with the Vesda that have changed mm-hmm. the way they act and who they are. And I'm thinking Batel is actually going to be a key linchpin in creating the Gorn that we know, going back to what they originally were more like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just where I'm guessing all that goes. But I think that the reason that we saw the Gorn become such an issue in the second season and now here at the beginning of the third season is because they sensed that Corby's work was messing around with the Vesda. And that's what woke them up, because we have this idea that they're on cycles, right? You know, maybe that's where all of that comes into play. And that's how we're going to kind of possibly tie the Gorn themselves back into their more classic form that we know, but at the same time have this whole new understanding of them. But also, we're getting really almost a backstory of how the Q became the Q, and the actual kind of havoc that that caused on the galaxy. So there's a lot of implications, it feels like you mentioned, that this puzzle has a lot of galactic implications for mm-hmm. the Star Trek alternate universe that we're in, you know, and how all these things came to be. So, and again, this is the type of stuff, it's like, this is what you should be doing. This is the mm-hmm. interesting stuff that I really want more of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, that's all really interesting. So you're suggesting that the Gorn used to look more like the Gorn in Arena, and then they became like these mini Godzillas that we see. And then maybe with the help of Batel's DNA and it merging together, they will return more to the form that they were before.
I think that that's how they're going to get to where they go. That we're in the sense of, they've talked about this idea behind the scenes that, you know, we're going to kind of connect to the place that we understand the Gorn to be. So whether or not mm-hmm. the Gorn kind of feel more like the Gorn we saw in Enterprise, you know, so they have a slightly more dinosaur type feel to them than what yeah. we get in Arena, that would make more sense, right? That there would be, so because that's kind of a nice bridge between yeah. the looks. And so
yeah, it would make more sense, although I hope we don't see the Gorn from Enterprise again, because I don't think that came off particularly well.
Well, I mean, you do it in today's effects and it's going to look completely different. I mean, you yeah. know, like I think yeah. that's the thing. You're not going to end up with that look. It just, you know, it won't happen. So, mm-hmm. But you could end up with something that looks like a cross between what we've got now and Arena. And I think if you do a good job of what you got in Enterprise, that makes mm-hmm. more sense to me.
I just hope they keep the same fashion sense that they had in Arena.
Oh, hopefully. I mean, I need, you know, more bright patterns yeah. and so all that stuff should be there.
So okay, so let's talk about the ancient evil right now, because it ties into what we're talking about. So I think that sounds interesting, and I mentioned in the intro that there was a lizard fight in sickbay, and I've gone back and rewatched that part of the episode many, many times. I've watched mm-hmm. it in slow motion, so I could really clearly see actually not that part in slow motion. I watched the recap at the beginning where we see the mind meld that Spock had with Batel, so we see the creature, right. yep. whatever he yep. saw. And then I've also watched in slow motion when he looks into the orb mm-hmm. inside yep. the prison.
Yep, they're the same.
They are the same.
Yeah.
So I've seen a few people online say that, no, they're not the same. You know, this one has two eyes and this one has four eyes and they're,
yeah.
no, they're the same. So the teeth and the tongue and all are identical.
Yeah, all that gives it away. Yeah.
So they are the same. So what I'm wondering is, there are a few things. So whatever's inside Batel apparently came about because she had the Gorn eggs in her. And there's residual Gorn DNA.
Sure.
And there's something inside her that kind of takes over her mind from time to time. And Spock can sense it in the mind meld.
Mm-hmm.
So you would assume that that's a Gorn. But here in this prison, in the middle of Indiana Jones and the prisoners of Azkaban that we're watching here, he looks in there and he sees the same creature. But the implication here is, as you've just been talking about, is that imprisoned inside these orbs are the Vesda. So are the Vesda and the Gorn the same original species? Are they different? Did they have an interaction millennia ago, which is why Batel has the reaction she has to Gamble? What I find interesting, though, is that when Batel comes into sickbay and she sees Gamble, she says, "You," as if whatever's inside her and whatever is inside Gamble recognize each other, that they knew each other a long, long, long time ago, which made me think, were they both prisoners and one of them escaped and then one of them was still in the prison? Did the two, these two specific entities, did they have a conflict with each other in the past? Or is it just this race and this race who hate each other and recognize each other? It's not clear at all what's going on. And I think that I don't know what, where the writers are going with this, but it feels incredibly muddy to me right now. And I do wonder if it's a case of the writers knowing where they're going and the visual effects team undermining what they're doing, letting them down by using the same visual. I really don't have a clear picture of how this fits together.
My answer with that is that the reason in which when Spock melds with Batel, that what happens there is a picture of what is driving the Gorn, the thing they fear.
So he's not seeing what's inside Batel. He's seeing some memory they have. I think
what he's seeing is a representation of what they fear, but also partly what they are, because the reason the Gorn are the way they are is because there's been this mixture between them and the Vesda somehow that has created Gorn, which is different than they used to be. Hence the hate that they have for the Vesda in the first place. That's just...
makes sense.
It makes sense. And again, it'll be one of those things that if that's what happens, I think it'll make sense once we kind of get to the full reveals. Otherwise, yeah, I think, you know, what you're asking is... I mean, it's all very legitimate in the sense that is this just something where we're not doing a great job? I can't think, though, because that would be a huge mistake to have a visual effects error like that. I mean, not only would that be a huge mistake, it would be a downright catastrophe of a mistake, right? For that, and I just can't imagine that that's possible. With as long as they worked on this season and had to work on this season because of the writer's strike and all that stuff. Like, I cannot imagine. Because the other thing about this season, too, is for the most part, I think the visual effects have been really well done.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed to be like, you know, that the company had a long time to work on them, you know? So,
well, you can imagine, you know, years ago on Star Trek, you can imagine them doing something like that because they don't have budget to make a new creature. And so they use the same effect and all, which is not an issue these days with the technology that we have. You can easily modify it and make it something different. So yes, I would assume that it's very much intended to be the same.
Yeah.
As you watch it, just from a storytelling standpoint, though, it does, things are very muddy because your first reaction to how Batel behaves and how Gamble behaves is that, and knowing the Gorn background for Batel and the Vesda background for Gamble, you assume that these are two different species who hate each other. Yeah, that's your first like instant reading of it, right? And then the fact that we only see these creatures that Spock sees just for a split second, right? We don't see them long enough to really tell anything about them other than they look very similar. You can only tell that they're the same when you go back and you watch it over several times, or even when you do slow motion like I did, which is not something you should expect a viewer to do. So I think that if the intention is that, either way, if the intention is that they are the same or they're different, I do think that it should have been presented more clearly to the viewer so that this part of the story isn't quite as confusing as it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can agree with you on that. You know, I think, you know, the whole story should be Christine Chapel, Tomb Raider, and the prisoner of the dimensional prison. You know, I mean, that's not an exciting name, but you get what I'm saying. Like that
the murderers of the multiverse.
Yeah. Prison of the multiverse. So, Because, I mean, it, you know, there's some really interesting stuff. You know, you talk about this idea of, like, the ancient evil and its connection and all that. There is actually, I think, a pretty pertinent question, because Pelia has one response to this, and Pike has another. And Pelia says that these creatures are true evil. They are just plain, good old-fashioned evil. There's nothing, you know, and being a Lanthanite and so long lived, she's basically saying, hey, this is something that's so old, I don't remember a time where it didn't exist, kind of thing. And what's fascinating is to see Pike disagree and say, you know, to the question he gets from Sam, that's relative. Those are relative terms. Yeah. And which we just had an episode. This is a place where the writing really bothered me. We just had an episode where Pike is like, all right, I got to start praying. So the dude was not only brought up in a Christian household, but also seems to be a person who, through his portrayal, does kind of believe that there is a good and an evil in the universe. And to say this doesn't, one, jive with the character, but two, I mean, it's a huge question, because in a relative universe where you actually do believe everything is relative, how can you actually say what is good and what is evil? Because you really can't, because the terms, again, are just your opinion and therefore don't necessarily really have any true definitions other than your own thought process on what that means. So that is a massive question that obviously something like Deep Space Nine dealt with in a lot of detail, right? When it came to the Pot Wraiths and the prophets and all that kind of stuff. Here, I find this, it's like, I find the discussion to be sophomorish and very amateurish and not well done. Because if you're going to have this discussion, you should probably put a little bit more thought into the writing process if you're going to start throwing around these type of terms and this these type of questions. So maybe they'll deal with it later on in the, you know, and possibly with through the next few episodes. But as we've talked about the writing this season, I don't trust that that'll probably happen.
Well, I don't really think they're going to revisit that personally. I mean, as far as Pike, we're not sure if he grew up in a Christian household, but he grew up in a household that valued religions. It just a little background info, because I know a lot of people didn't watch Discovery. In the second season, second episode called New Eden, Pike does say that his father was a science teacher who also taught comparative religion. So he learned a lot about religions growing up. And that's where the stuff that we see, like him praying at the end of the episode with Batel, comes from that. It's not something just kind of like thrown out here. And even in the cage, you know, there's the fire that he sees, that also I feel anyway in my head canon that that probably came from a story that his father told him about the belief, you know, the idea of hell in Christianity, for example. So this like religious aspect of Pike has been around for a long time. What I felt watching it, especially the first time, is that I feel like they just threw in the basic standard Star Trek premise of good and evil are relative. Everything's relative, which, you know, it's an idea that I think there's great value in that idea in terms of creating a society in which people can talk to each other and value each other and try not to judge each other to the point that society falls apart. And I think in our own world, in recent decades, we've seen that taken to an extreme by some, which has led to a backlash in society and a naivety that can sometimes lead to trouble. Because if you can't acknowledge that there is real evil, then you eventually will fall into some traps that are very bad for people and bad for society. So it's not purely like everything is always, you know, it can be either way. I think that they just tossed that in there. And then Pelia, they used Pelia to quickly say, but that's not the real world. And so she's saying that there is real evil in this universe.
Yeah.
But I also think that the way that Carol Kane delivered all of that, it's just so overly dramatic. And it was like she was trying to audition for this documentary that Beto is making and all. Yeah. That it kind of the whole point of her message kind of got washed away because of the way it was delivered. And so that entire scene just came off as very clunky. Yeah.
100% agree. I one of my main complaints there is that much like many of the Marvel movies, the humor in this episode completely undercut many of the really important moments. And you got to stop doing that, writers, because it doesn't help your episode. It makes light of what's actually really important. And Pelia doing that hurts her credibility then in what she just said that's supposed to be really important. And again, I mean, this is supposed to be a Star Trek question, right? Mm-hmm. This idea of what is the makeup of the universe? And is there such a thing as good and evil? And if there are, how do we make that decision on what that is? You know, because that does mean then that there are going to be some things that are right and some things that are wrong. And not all cultures can be all right all the time because there has to be some sort of standard. All of these types of questions are incredibly interesting. And I mean, well done philosophically. And yet there's just this, almost like we feel in the episode that, oh, well, we have to say this, these two things, but there's no real intentionality of wanting to dig into what that means. And that's disappointing because that's actually what Star Trek has traditionally been best at, right?
Yeah, yeah,
when you think about all the way from TOS, all the way through Enterprise, you know, we've been watching through Enterprise with the rewatch, and especially in season three, whether you like that or not, it does ask a lot of really pertinent questions about good and evil and response to all these type of things. And what's a healthy, valid response, what's not a good response, what's over the top response, like all these types of things. And so that, again, Star Trek has tended to be more nuanced in these ideas for the most part. Mm-hmm. And we would hope that would be the case that was here, but you know, it's not quite as much. So,
right. Well, and I think at the end of Pelia's whole thing, her stopping and saying, do you want one for the camera? Made it feel like she was making everything about the evil overly dramatic because she was trying to make the documentary more exciting.
Yep.
Or, you know,
exactly.
It was just a bad light. Speaking of the documentary, what do you think about this whole idea? I know in Deep Space Nine, they had Jake being a reporter for the Starfleet, the Federation News Service, but this whole insertion of this character of Beto Ortegas, and he's there because they want to commission a full documentary about Starfleet or the Federation. It and then he's using cameras which are AI powered, which is like the most in the moment thing you could possibly say in a science fiction series set in the 23rd century. I don't think AI powering little cameras that fly around as drones would be any kind of cutting edge technology 250 years from now.
No, because the Enterprise computer is an AI system.
Right. So this is something that I feel like it's just stuck in the episode to have, it's sort of like it catches the moment that we're in right now, but it feels like a very superfluous element to have in the story in the first place. And maybe it's only there so that he can catch a glimpse of that room. I know they set up the documentary part in a previous episode, but the actual flying camera, and you could have done that in other ways.
I think the problem with it is that all of a sudden we've turned this into Parks and Rec or The Office.
If someone puts his drone camera in Jell-O and puts it in his desk drawer, then I'm going to know.
They should, because that's exactly what they're kind of turning this series into. And this is one of those places where, you know, we've talked about this season. Stop trying to be so clever and in the moment, because what you do, again, to harken back to Enterprise, this is one of the complaints that people have about season three, right? Is that people feel that it's too in the moment, and our thoughts and feelings a couple of years later about 9/11. Mm-hmm. Now, as we've been watching the show 20 years on, I can see that read of it, but I can also see it being a larger read on a more historical thought process on all of this stuff. I don't think it's just as tied into the moment as many people thought it might be. Right.
No, because it reads well now, and it reads differently than it did in the moment.
And yet, like you mentioned, with this whole documentary thing and with the AI technology and all that, they make a big deal out of it. And yes, it really does seem to be, hey, we're all talking about AI, so we're going to throw that in as if that means anything in Star Trek, in a world where the Enterprise computer is the most advanced AI system there is, because it helps run the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Like a ship that's so complicated, we can't even really fathom the type of complicated that is.
Yeah.
Let's
not forget that in this time period, a few years before these events, a runaway AI almost took over the entire Federation because it was so powerful and intelligent on Discovery. And they had to fight and destroy that. I bring this up not to complain like, wow, that was a terrible thing in the episode so much. But the main reason I bring it up is that there are elements like this that are being thrown into what is otherwise a very interesting story that aren't really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
They could just focus on the actual mystery that they've got going here and take a great episode and make it a superior episode if they focus a little bit more, instead of trying to put so many elements in, just like trying to, like, everybody on the Enterprise has got to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend now. So you've got Beto Ortegas on here. I have felt from the beginning of the season being here for no other reason than to give Uhura a love interest, which we see in this episode as part of the temple or prison pairing. Well, it pairs them off differently, but Uhura and Betos do get paired off together when everyone is split up among rooms. And that's a case where all the tension, which we talked about earlier, like Spock and Corby, Spock and Chapel, La'an's now with Spock, you've got Uhura and Betos, like all this, the trio of love that we've got going on here is also an element that I really feel isn't necessary for the story. Not a big deal, but it's one of these things where, like, they're trying to push this part of the narrative in a story where they could have just let it sit on the sideline for a week.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is at the beginning of the episode, you have the whole conversation with La'an and Christine, and La'an is such an adult about this. Right. Mm-hmm. She's basically like, I'm going to stop you right there. You can put all your junior high BS to the side. I don't care about that. And this is why I don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so Spock and I are doing our thing. We're not calling it anything right now. We're just, hey, saying we're having a good time together. We're getting to know each other. We're not even calling anything. I don't care. It's like the most adult thing that you could have in the conversation, right? And so it really goes to show, actually, the adolescent nature of the whole Spock-Chapel relationship. And actually, I think it really goes more to show the adolescent nature of Chapel as a character. And then, again, she really comes off as being this kind of YA-written character, and she kind of drags Spock down with her in that. Whereas the La'an storyline is making Spock much more interesting as a character, and actually making him, actually allowing him to be much more himself, but at the same time be a better version of himself, I think. And so all of that's great. And then I could care less about whether Uhura and this guy get together or not. Like, I just don't care about him. Yeah. And it just, like you said, I don't think it muddles the story or muddies the story or anything like that. It feels like a place to not focus because we have enough other good things to focus on in the series rather than this. And I would like to see more. Again, if there's one challenge that I have to the writers of this show, is focus. Figure out what the core crux of the storylines for the characters are and make sure that all of the story elements then help wrap around that and bring that to light. Because a lot of this episode does a lot of good for a lot of characters. Spock, La'an, Pike, and Batel, and M'Banga, and his relationship then with Gamble and the way that that's impacted him, especially in light of the fact that he, you know, kind of lost his daughter. I mean, she's not really lost, but she's moved to a different plane of existence.
She's
now
in a cloud called Deborah, you remember?
Yeah, a cloud called Deborah. Anyway, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that's happening there. And we talked about, we are creating an interesting through line for the idea of the Gorn, this idea of the Q, and this introduction of this race, the Vesda, who seem to be out for the annihilation, basically, of everything that we would understand as life in mm-hmm. our universe. So those are some pretty great stakes. Make sure, then, that every episode is informing all of those storylines you already have going. There's no reason to create all these other dangling threads with characters like who Uhura might or might not be dating that happens to be related to Ortegas for some reason. Because reasons. It's just...
By some reason, you mean why he's there, not why he's related to Ortegas. That's
well,
because they have the same parents.
Well, I would argue that just having to have him also be related to Ortegas is just another thing that hasn't really added anything to the story.
Because they haven't. Yeah, they haven't explored that.
Not really. So, no. So
yeah, one leap that my mind made for a moment about these prisoners is that I thought, what if the god entity in Star Trek V is one of these Vesda who has been trapped there also to keep him from taking over and destroying the galaxy?
You will bring the starship to me.
What does God need with a starship?
I guess one reason I thought about it too is because the Gamble Vesda here wants to take over the ship. Still will take over the ship because as we saw the screen glitch at the end, he's in the system now.
Yeah. Oh man, the ghost in the shell right there. The Nurse Gamble thing is interesting. One, can I just say that the white shirt and black pants is such a better look than the really dumb onesie that they give them to wear? I mean, that works for Chapel.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work for Dude, I'm sorry. And so when they put them in the white shirt and the black pants, or you could have given Chapel the white dress, because La'an will wear that. And so we'll, number one, right? There are many times when they're wearing the dress version and they have, you know, like a tight pant that kind of makes everything look classier than, you know, what we would see in the original series because this is the 60s. You know, bloomers don't really go anymore. So that was great. I loved that look. I think they should just transition to that completely and it would be much better. But you know, you said something interesting on the outline, and it's very clear that Gamble has only been here for this reason. But I think more importantly, it's not just for this reason, because as we mentioned, it has an impact on M'Banga, right? He's grown very fond of this boy.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Treated him much like a son in many ways, and now he's losing him. He's lost him. He's gone. And so I think that is really, really interesting because in a lot of ways, it creates, sadly, even more trauma for M'Banga to kind of work out, which for a character who has had as much trauma he's already had, I feel like he's had enough. But that's where, to me, I really enjoyed the way in which we were utilizing a lot of, this is where the writing I thought was good. We've utilized this stuff. I thought we've inserted this character well, and then we've had it all go wrong, and it's smart, I thought, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point about his impact on Mbenga. It would have been nice if they had explored that a little bit more leading up to this point, because my sure. feeling about Gamble from the beginning was, from the first episode, it's like, okay, so we're going to introduce another character. And I don't mind, you know, Deep Space Nine showed that you can have 30 characters and you can do them all justice. But unfortunately, that was an outlier in Star Trek, and certainly in modern Star Trek. My frustration largely stems from Discovery, where you had a bridge crew that we never learned anything about. So here, I want them to explore the core characters that they have instead of bringing more people on. Agreed. So when Gamble yes. showed up, I was like, okay, so we're going to have another character on the show this season. That's fine. Let's see where it goes. But then when this episode came about, it was very clear that, well, they brought him on the show and they set him up for a few episodes so that they could do this episode and they would right. have someone who we've come to know who they could kill off because they need someone to be possessed and to be killed.
Exactly.
And, you know, that goes back on Discovery. They had a character called Arium who was killed, and her crewmates were so devastated. But as the audience, like, well, we don't really know anything about her. She just stands over there at this console all the time. And they tried to give her a background in the episode where she dies.
Yeah.
Which is not the way to do it, right? And so with Gamble, though, at the beginning of this episode, I knew, okay, something bad's going to happen to him in this episode because he was so excited. He's recording his log. You know, he's so excited about everything. Well, I thought, well, this can't be good.
And there's that moment where he's like, and this was going to be the day that changed my life. And I was like, wait, what? How does he know that?
Yeah.
That I was like, again, come on, guys. You got to think through when he's recording the log, which is like, he should just be excited he's going on his first mission. He has no idea whether this is going to change his life. Why would he know that?
Right. Well, it's sort of a mix up of how, and you see this in the original series. Well, there's kind of a contrast, right? In the original series, Kirk's logs are, the captain's logs are kind of after the fact telling, you know, recording for history what happened. Whereas in The Next Generation, you get a lot of logs which are in the moment, like we're going right. here, we're going to do this, right?
Yeah.
And this one was maybe a little bit of a hybrid of that. But
which doesn't make sense because he's dead and been taken over by an alien, so he would never get to record this.
Well, but we don't know. Maybe Vesda liked to record logs also. And
it's true. It's true. Yeah. Again, we don't know.
We don't know, but
yeah.
But,
oh my.
You know, I will say that it gave Chris Myers a good send-off. I thought he did a really nice job in the role. He got to display a range of acting, and I thought the contrast in what he did was really good. But it's too bad that he had to turn out. The story was, as I put on the outline for this section, a wider shade of red shirt. Yeah, which was too bad. All right. Well, okay. So let's move on because we're getting pretty close to an hour. Last thing, I guess, to just talk about is how they escape the temple, because it's a leap of faith. And I was curious, and this is one of the parts that conjures up so many memories of Indiana Jones. Did you feel that? Okay, well, first of all, I'm just going to rewind for a second. This was something that was mentioned to me by Mark, one of our longtime listeners, that they could have, instead of arguing over whether to continue the mission, they could have just gone over to the door where they had a clear signal and called up to the ship and gotten Pike to make a decision as a captain and then gone. But instead, they stay in there and then they get trapped. So then they have to find their way out. So the whole process of finding their way out, how they had to work together, I thought was reasonably interesting. The idea that they're all actually in the same room, they can't see each other because they're on different planes of existence, but somehow they can still communicate with each other over the communicator and give each other instructions. Okay, well, that's fine. I'll go with it. But the actual resolution at the end to go over and have to cross a bridge that they can't see seemed like a pretty easy solution to everything that had been built up to that point. Basically, when they walked out the door, it was sort of like, okay, we're done.
Yeah. So this is one of those places where you're being slavish to your inspiration for no good reason, because you're not thinking about the reality of the way in which this would work in the universe you're writing in. This is the problem with these writers. Again, they think they're being really clever. We're giving you Indiana Jones. Remember that scene in The Last Crusade where he has to take the leap of faith? Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, the thematic elements and what's happening there in that story make all that make sense. This makes zero sense. When you just would have like, hey, Chapel and La'an, just dip your toe mm-hmm. there. Or maybe get on your hands and knees and like put mm-hmm. a hand out and see what happens. Like, that's the scientific way to do this. Again, you have to understand what you're adapting to the universe you're in. So mm-hmm. if you want to do homages to other things, that's great. I loved the fact that we did this whole like Tomb Raider, Indiana Jones style adventure. I think that's wonderful because, you know, I mean, Star Trek in many ways is kind of like Star Wars, and it's those adventure serials of Buck Rogers and all that kind of stuff are influences, right? So that's wonderful.
Oh, man, what if Tweaky had been inside the temple? That would have been
so
cool.
That's I think it's great. But you then need to, I think through the reality of, okay, how does that translate to Star Trek? Mm-hmm. And too many times, I think, this season, they have, and even, I think, in the second season, there's some issues with this, but they're just kind of doing straight up homages without really massaging it in a way that makes more sense for the universe we actually are in. And so that's kind of my frustration with that, because it just doesn't quite work, I think, the way they want it to.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, like you say, they could have tested it out, tossed the tricorder on there and see if it keeps falling or if it hits
anything.
Except that there could be the implication that this ancient power that built this place, because of the way that it only liked Chapel, scanned her blood, let them in because of that, that it somehow has a way of, and also it took over Gamble, like got into his brain and everything. Maybe it has some way of actually scanning people's brains. And this is kind of a test of faith to see. Like, so if you just touched it, if you threw something on it, maybe the bridge wouldn't have been there. Like, it can only appear if you really take that leap of faith and you take that step and put yourself out there. You know, that's a possibility. Although that's typically not how things would work in the Star Trek universe, right?
Well, and I think the other part of this is like, we already established the science, quote unquote, of this mm-hmm. through Spock, which was this idea that effect can happen before cause because of the temporal displacement of this structure. Mm-hmm. And so we don't need to take a leap of faith. There is no leap of faith. The only faith is whether or not Spock is right about the science, which Spock is always right about the science. Yeah. So there's, but if you really want to do that well, by them saying that through Spock, what you've actually done is you removed the whole leap of faith part, and it's really just about does Christine and Doolan, do they trust Spock? These two women who have had relationship with Spock, do they trust him? That's where the trust comes in. It's not really about the other part to me.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I will say the cause and effect, things happening, effects happening before causes and such. They did set that up well with Spock's finger and the cut.
Yeah, I thought that was great. You know, so exactly.
You know, they did set it up so that part wasn't like, oh, suddenly let's do this at the end. I thought that was all set up pretty well.
Yeah,
I just felt a little bit of a letdown that the ultimate resolution was so easy when they just walk out and like, okay, yeah, yeah, we almost died in there. We almost got trapped for 1,000 years and starved to death. But
well, and the interesting thing about that is right, you would have been trapped if you didn't have the pieces that they did. You know, you had to have those keys that Corby had collected for them to be able to do what they did.
Right.
Otherwise, they would have just ended up, there wouldn't have been any way out, so.
All right, well, what are your final thoughts and what's your rating for this one?
Yeah, actually, this is a better episode. As I mentioned, I think this is a much better episode. I think a lot in this episode works a lot better than we saw previously. And I like the way in which we're trying to, I think, connect the story threads for the season. So I'm glad that's finally starting to happen to make some sort of sense. And I really do hope that continues. And so, yeah, I think I'm going to have to give this episode, and I'm going to be generous, it's probably more like a 3.5, but actually just in light of all that we've experienced this season so far, I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5 glowing Firefly balls that you should not touch, because it's just a much stronger episode. And it could have been, I think, the strongest episode actually of the season if you had just massaged and maybe reworked some of the things that we mentioned. And so, yeah, I think that would be great.
Yeah, same for me. I think it's a really good episode. It's a great premise. Feels like the original series with a modern twist to it. Maybe a bit too much reliance on familiar themes, as we've discussed from other movies. But overall, it's a huge improvement in the storytelling and the type of stories that they're telling. And it opens up a lot of big questions. And we'll see where those go. I'm especially interested to find out what this whole Gorn Vesda thing really is. So I'm going to give this one 8 Chinese characters.
All right.
That also raises a question that I hope will be answered in a future episode about whoever these people are that built this place. As Chapel asked, why is there an Earth language here? Why is there Chinese there? I'm very curious if that means that whoever built this, whether it's the Q or it's some other race, like, did they visit various planets? Did they have some sort of influence on Chinese culture or Earth culture? You know, if you're going to pick a language, Chinese is one of the oldest written languages like this, and it's one that is different than most, and it's an interesting one to choose if you're going to do that. So I'm curious where that goes. All right, everyone. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Through the Lens of Time as well. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook, to the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. And to find it, just type Babel Conference into the search field and you'll get there. You'll find a post on the timeline there for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email, go to our website, trek.fm/contact, use the form you find there, choose to send to a show and choose Saddle Up, and that'll come to us by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not getting ready to fight those big lizards that are in your backyard, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, outside all this great Star Trek talk that we do, you can find me over in the 602 Club. Talking about all those other franchises we love outside of this Star franchise. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network doing a couple of shows. One is called Owlpost. It's a completed show about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And I'm doing aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. Now, Chris, when you're not trying to figure out if you're going to wear the white onesie Or if you're going to, you know, possibly just wear the shirt and the pants today, where can people find you?
Yeah, I love the onesie. Mine actually has, it goes all the way down to my feet. It has like the it's all one piece, and it has a little traction on the bottom so I won't slip as I'm running around trying to get away from the Gorn. But you can find me elsewhere on the network doing all the shows with you. As you mentioned, you can also find me in the back catalog in many shows, and you can find me on social media. My username everywhere is C Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active, but you can send me a message wherever you are. And if you'd like to help us keep the show and everything else we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you to everyone who is helping us now. Well, Matthew, I hope you're hungry, because next time we're going to talk about the Saylot who ate its tail.
Well, Chris, you know, hopefully it was tasty. Hit it.